From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In less than an hour now, President Bush will step to the podium and deliver his State of the Union address. The address comes at the midpoint of his presidential term, and the challenges ahead, as he will say, are huge. The economy is struggling. Medicare is on life support. War looms with Iraq, and beyond that, with a stateless enemy. A year ago, even 2 months ago, the president was riding sky high in the nation's esteem. He remains a widely admired president. But the polls show him slipping. Support for war with Iraq is waning. Seniors are shaking empty pill bottles in protest at punishing prescription costs. Faith in his economic stewardship has weakened, too. But this president has stepped up before and come out a winner. Tonight, On Point, the Bush presidency at the crossroads and the road ahead for the nation. We'll be joined in this hour by a great lineup: Eleanor Clift, Andrew Kohut, E.J. Dionne, Brian York, our own Jack Beatty, and you. What word or phrase describes the State of the Union to you tonight? Where is President Bush taking the country, and do you like the destination? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Eleanor Clift, contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. Good evening and welcome, Eleanor Clift.
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you back. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Eleanor Clift, give us the down and dirty first. You're inside that famous beltway. What's the consensus? What does the president need to accomplish in his speech tonight?
I think he needs to get his poll ratings back over 60%, to put it in crass political terms. He's got to reassure the country that he knows what he's doing on potential war with Iraq and prepare the country for a war that now seems pretty inevitable. And he's got to reassure the country that the tax plan that he sent to Capitol Hill will somehow revive the economy. His so-called stimulus plan, or jobs plan, I think he prefers to call it, has landed with a dull thud on Capitol Hill, and it's not only Democrats who are complaining, it's Republicans who are complaining. If he didn't have the mantle of the 9/11 war leader, I think this president would be in big trouble.
And yet, in 1984, Ronald Reagan won re-election with something less than 60% approval rating. Is President Bush's rating really so bad? Is it only compared to post-9/11, that epic high?
Oh, it's relatively high, but I think that the president and his advisors have used his poll ratings as their shield against criticism, against Democratic questioning of their priorities. I mean, it has basically been the chief reason, I think, for the confidence that this administration has shown as it prepares to take bold risks on the world stage, risks that really make our allies very uneasy and that increasingly make Americans at home nervous.
Eleanor Clift, you've been watching this president from the beginning. Now here he is, right smack dab in the middle of his term. We all watched him unfold, blossom, many would have said, after 9/11, to step up when that kind of profile of leadership was required. What do you see in the year plus now since that big star turn? Do you see a changing profile?
Well, I see an over-reliance on the war and an over-reliance on the way the country rallied around him after 9/11. And I see on the part of the political advisors, I think, an exploitation of the fears about another terrorist attack as really a way to avoid facing up to some of the problems here at home. I think it's worked for him very well through the November elections last year. But if you measure from last November until now, the kind of ugly toppling of a Republican leader in the Senate,
Trent Lott,
a very uneasy beginning to the new Homeland Security Department, I think the president doesn't seem to know what to do with the extraordinary power that he has. I mean, he has all the levers here in Washington, both houses of Congress, much of the court system, and he seems a little taken aback that the first major thing that he's asked for, this jobs/stimulus package, seems to be declared, if not dead on arrival on Capitol Hill, certainly on life support. And so I think he needs to get out and sell more of these things. And I think the questioning about whether these policies are wise, given the budgetary strains that this country is facing, that's another area that he has really ignored.
And yet we've seen George Bush up against the wall before come out very strong, kind of swing for the fences. As you say, he's made a mark in the last year with the bold gesture, and the previews that the White House has put out over the last couple of days all indicate that that's the pose he's likely to strike again tonight, going for great causes, great challenges.
Yeah, but he's been politically with his back up against the wall. I think there are some realities here that are very difficult to ignore. You know, an economy that doesn't come back, deficit numbers that climb and climb, North Korea, which doesn't seem to be bowing down to the president's tough rhetoric. I think this is more than a political problem he's gotten himself into. I think these are serious problems that demand real solutions, not just a rhetorical flourish.
Is this a president who can reach out in the midst of those real problems for that famous bipartisan approach?
I guess it's never too late for that, but I think the November election created a lot of damage on Capitol Hill. The fact that the Republicans went after a Democrat who was a Vietnam veteran who lost three limbs in Vietnam and essentially accused him of not caring enough about the country.
Georgia's Max Cleland.
Absolutely, because he had voted against the Homeland Security Department if it didn't have protections for workers. I've been in Washington since December of 1976, and I've never seen the relations between the two parties this badly frayed, under Newt Gingrich.
And what about within the Republican Party on Capitol Hill, the Republican congressional members, Eleanor Clift? What do you feel, what do you sense there in terms of their confidence?
Well, you saw a revolt in the last couple of weeks where they feel that they're not being let in on the war news. They feel the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, treats them as though they're not worth consulting. And so the administration has tried to make some amends there. And you've got some members of the Republican Party, notably Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, who is a decorated Vietnam veteran, openly questioning some of the priorities on the war. And then, as I've said a couple of times here, the economic package is not faring well at all.
It's not moving. Eleanor Clift, I know you have a State of the Union speech to prepare for. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's been great to have you.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, Eleanor Clift, giving us there a fairly checkered view of the prospect from the president's vantage at this moment.
Yeah, my hypothesis is that this White House is losing its political touch. And I trace it back, really, to the departure of Karen Hughes. Andrew Card, the chief of staff, said that he feared what would happen after she would go. And I think we've seen what would happen. Her whole approach was to have broad, unifying themes. The person whose influence has superseded her is Karl Rove. He favors peeling off one section of the electorate, setting it against the other. And you look at the decisions, dividend, the cut on double taxation. A Bolshevik like Alan Greenspan says, no, sorry, we don't need that. The speech against affirmative action, 54% of Americans support it. And now this Medicare plan to say basically to seniors, okay, you want the drug prescription benefit, then you're going to give up your doctor and go into an HMO. This is a kind of coercive plan. This betrays, I think, a waning of political touch.
Waning of touch, Karen Hughes, we're out there. And yet we're told she's on the phone from Texas and she's been involved in the president helping craft the speech tonight. Maybe we'll see Karen Hughes' fingerprints on the State of the Union address in under an hour now. We're joined now from Washington by Andrew Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Kohut.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Andrew, you've got your fingers on all the poll numbers. Take us into that thicket a little more. We know they've been slipping, but what does that mean? Where are they slipping? Where are they still strong? How does this president look at midterm?
Well, in relative terms, he's still pretty high.
Yeah.
Historical terms. Mm-hmm. But relative to the recent past, this is a public that feels less safe from the threat of terrorism. It feels unsettled by the prospect of war in Iraq, by other foreign policy challenges, notably North Korea, and decidedly less confident than a year ago about the prospect for economic recovery nationally. Now, I don't want to overstate this and say that the bottom has fallen out in confidence in the economy or confidence in Bush, but all of this stuff is going in the wrong direction, as is President Bush's approval ratings. His approval ratings are mid-50s to high-50s, depending upon which poll you read, and that's a lot different than 75%, which is where it was a year ago. And we all know that in Washington, high poll ratings are capital, and the president is losing his capital, and that's what he has to deal with tonight. He has to regain some of his connection with the public, so he has more power here.
Andrew Cohut, take us into that. You're the pollster. You know how these numbers work well. Is it the absolute standing of a president in the polls or the dynamic? Is the fact that he's swooned from his high more important than the fact that, as you say, in historical terms, these are still pretty strong numbers?
Yeah, they are still strong numbers. But if you look at his terrorism rating is still in the 70s, but his rating for the economy in our poll last week was 47 approved, 45 disapproved. That's not very good. Now it can get a lot lower. It can go into the 30s or 20s. But then he would be in deep political trouble. What we now see are some disconcerting signs. And ever since the middle of 2002, we have been asking a question, is George Bush trying hard enough?
What do you mean by that?
We asked the question.
You're asking people, as a poll question.
Is President Bush trying hard enough to fix the economy? Mm-hmm. And we only get a third of the American public saying yes. And I think he has a real problem in Iraq is obviously something that demands attention, and the public wants the war on terrorism to go on. At the same time, by virtue of the amount of energy and effort and he spends on foreign policy in Iraq, the public thinks, well, maybe he's not doing as much on the economy.
How does President Bush stand at this point in his first term compared to his predecessor, Bill Clinton? His numbers were not too good at this point.
His numbers were lower than this. In 1995, that was a real low point for President Clinton. The Democrats had just lost the Congress after 40 years of control. And President Clinton came out and he gave a speech, a State of the Union speech, that really began the process of his reconnecting with the American public. He got very, very good ratings from the public, not so much from the pundit class, but from the public on that speech. And President Bush has to do a similar kind of thing. His situation is not nearly so desperate, but he's not the triumphant victor of the midterm elections that he was just a month and a half ago. He is seen as a president who is losing the public's confidence.
So what buttons do you think he needs to push in the speech less than an hour from now, Andrew Cohut?
Well, he's got to come back to Iraq and make people once again confident that there's a good reason, and he's going to reveal it, why we have to do this now. Mm-hmm. The public is disposed to go to war with Iraq if the conditions are right. Secondly, he has to somehow instill some confidence in the public that he has an economic program that will work. And so far, the reaction to the tax cut program has been far less than awesome. His ratings went down, not up, post the announcement of the new tax cut plan. So he's got work to do there. And generally, he has to address the broader domestic agenda, concern about Medicare, concern about the uninsured, and a whole range of things that have gotten lost over the past 15, 16 months, but people lost here in Washington, but people really still care about.
And if he hits it out of the park, Andrew Cohut, how much can a president turn it around with one State of the Union speech?
It can get him going in the right direction, but speeches don't change or determine a public's connection with a president. It's performance. It's not style. It's not rhetoric. It's what he delivers.
It really is the State of the Union, not what we say about it. Andrew Cohut, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Andrew Cohut joined us from Washington. He's director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. You can join us as well. We are talking about the State of the Union, about President Bush at midterm What word, what phrase describes the State of the Union to you tonight? Where is George W. Bush taking America? And do you like the destination? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point in Washington tonight. The congressmen, representatives, and senators are gathering on Capitol Hill right now. President Bush will make his way soon to the chamber there in the House of Representatives to deliver his State of the Union address. We're talking tonight about the state of that union, about President Bush at his midterm point, right in the middle of his presidential term. What word, what phrase describes the State of the Union to you tonight? And what would George Bush's perfect State of the Union look like? And how does that square with yours? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, it has not been a terribly easy hand this president's been dealt between terrorism and everything going on around the world and an economy that was not headed in a great direction. And still, those numbers aren't holding up so badly.
No, they're not. And he found out something on September 11th. That crisis presidentialized him. The halo, the effect of that is worn off. And now he's got another war that I'm just absolutely confident will put his poll numbers back up into the 70s. It's a terrible temptation for presidents to go into wars, partly to restore their popularity. But he's already seen that work once. And I expect he hopes to have it work again. I mean, we've had Karl Rove pretty much say as much.
Yes, we have, and it could be coming up, and it could be coming up very, very soon, though we're told there will be no declaration, no deadline tonight. We're going to hear a lot about Iraq and the president making the case on the Iraq war front. Jack, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now E.J. Dionne. He's a columnist for The Washington Post and the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. E.J. Dionne, welcome. It's great to have you back on Point.
Thank you. Good to be here.
E.J. Dionne, you have written that the president cannot have it both ways, that he's got a kind of go-for-broke presidency, as you describe it, I guess in line with that word, bold, but that there's a contradiction built into this presidency. How do you see that?
Well, yeah, I think there is a contradiction between trying to be a great foreign policy leader and a wartime president and trying to be a strong political leader who changes domestic policy and realigns the country to the Republicans. The president wants to do both, and that's why I call him a go-for-broke president. The problem is that in the process of doing that, he's created a lot of enemies. And in particular, he took a Democratic Party that supported him very, very strongly after 9/11. And by using national security issues in the last election, he has created a furious party. I don't think you've ever seen Democrats this angry. They're almost like Republicans were under Bill Clinton. In that article I wrote, I quoted Mary Landrieu, moderate Democrat from Texas.
Louisiana.
Louisiana.
Yes.
Very much from Louisiana, actually. And she is a moderate Democrat. She supported Bush on foreign policy, on military spending, and he went after her tooth and nail, and he made one big enemy out of her. And she pointed out, as many Democrats did, that what especially got in the Democrats' craw was their campaign against Max Cleland, a decorated veteran from Vietnam,
yes,
who, as Mary Landrieu put it, left three limbs in Vietnam. He's disabled. Mm-hmm. And to go after him on security issues seemed one step too far. And I think the result of that is that Democrats who had been very, very timid about criticizing Bush, and if, you know, Democrats say lots of nice things about Bush, then the electorate will probably believe them. Well, now suddenly they're not doing that anymore. And I think that's one piece of this decline in the polls that Andy Kohut talked
about.
But
E.J. Dionne, all presidents are tasked to champion their own party, and all opposition parties become bitterly opposed to the president as a new election approaches. What is it that you seem to be pointing to something singular or really different in the way President Bush is pushing his bold go-for-broke agenda? Take us to the heart of that distinction you're making.
Well, the distinction is whether you are in the middle of a war or not. And that when World War II started, FDR was very explicit. He said Dr. New Deal, as he called it, is giving way to Dr. Win the War. And he let go of a lot of his New Deal dreams in order to bring Republicans in. He appointed a bunch of Republicans into the White House. The problem is it's hard to have it both ways. You're correct that it's not surprising. George Bush is a partisan Republican. He wants Republicans to win. But it's very hard to do both of these things at the same time. I think that you're seeing the decline in Iraq partly because of this new partisan split in the country, and partly because clearly Iraq is not Afghanistan. In the case of Afghanistan, there was almost uniform support for the president because Americans saw it as very closely linked as a response, a logical response to 9/11. In this case, Americans do not like Saddam Hussein. They do think he's dangerous. They're just not certain or convinced yet that this war is necessary to contain him, and I think that's the president's biggest job tonight.
How do you see the president being read right across the political spectrum, though? I mean, I can't help hearing a kind of gloominess, glass half empty or draining beyond that. And yet, as you point out, conservatives are ecstatic over what they see as President Bush's boldness.
Well, in fact, I think what we're seeing is a sharp partisan polarization, and independents in a way are out of this. It's a sharp partisan polarization that began under Bill Clinton, where, you know, I swear if Bill Clinton had put $1 million in the pocket of every single American, he would still have had at least a 35% disapproval rating from the Republicans who just couldn't stand him. For a while, Bush overcame that polarization, especially after 9/11. It's now coming back with, I think, a passion among Democrats. I don't think the bloc against Bush is yet as big as that bloc was against Bill Clinton, but it's starting to form, and I think that's a potential danger for him, even though, as you say, the passion of the Republican Party on the other side is also extraordinary. I've tried to think back to presidents who had more unified their party and were stronger party leaders, and I got back to McKinley and I stopped. I mean, I just don't think in the last 100 years you've seen a president, and based on the poll numbers, who has this much unity inside his own ranks.
Inside the party, a lot of happiness. E.J. Dionne, over the weekend, Bill Keller had a piece in the New York Times. And at the end of it, he summarized, he was comparing, you no doubt saw it, comparing George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. At the end of it, he summarized what he saw as the kind of Bush vision, what he's striving for, where he wants to push the country. And he talks about markets unleashed, resources exploited, I guess code there for environmental issues, a progressive tax system leveled, a country unashamed of wealth, government entitlements replaced by thrift, self-reliance, private goodwill, the safety net strung closer to the ground, government infused with efficiency and accountability, a court system dedicated to protecting property, and finally, a global common market that hums to the tune of American productivity. In the world, America rampant, unfettered by international law, unflinching when challenged, unmatchable in its might, more interested in being respected than in being loved. Is that a portrait of the union that you see George Bush attempting to draw here?
You read that with such great passion. It was great. Broadly, I agreed with Keller's piece. I think George W. Bush is much more conservative than lots of people thought. I think it's becoming clearer and clearer. And in fact, if I have any small disagreement with that Keller piece, it's I think fundamentally George Bush is more conservative than Ronald Reagan, and Keller did hint at that, or at least willing to act more conservatively than Ronald Reagan did. I think the dividends tax cut is a very good example. I mean, that it's hard to think of a tax cut that would be more profoundly tilted toward the very well off, and Bush is willing to push for it on the grounds, Reagan-esque grounds, that this is good for investment. It's actually not a popular tax cut. I mean, this is the first time where Bush has opposed proposed a tax cut that has drawn real opposition inside his own party. 7 or 8 Republican senators have already said they've got problems with this. But that's, I can think, a symbol of how conservative in his bones George W. Bush really is.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the notion that there's this central contradiction in the Bush presidency, that he wants to be a wartime president, but he's not prepared to make the kind of bipartisan embracing gestures and more than gestures that requires? Does that ring true to you?
Yes, I think he sees the war as an opportunity to further the agenda. In other words, rather than subordinating the agenda to the war, I think it's just the other way around, that the war is something he uses to advance the agenda. And that becomes more and more evident. I mean, within 2 days or something like that of 9/11, the Republicans, seemingly with the White House blessing, in the House were talking about, well, we've got to have a stimulus program that would, you know, cut taxes for corporations like Enron. And they have used at every juncture the war as a way of advancing their agenda. Now, that is to use sentiments of patriotism, sentiments of national wound, to advance an ideological cause. And I think that is beginning to show. That's what I meant when I talk about the loss of political touch.
Yeah, I get that. But is that so unusual? I mean, FDR used the national wound of the Depression and all those losses to push through some great changes. Is it so unusual for a president to say, we're in a tough moment, let's be bold, let's go for a big vision?
Well, you know, you talked – oh, I'm sorry. Is that for
no, go
Jack?
Ahead.
Well,
no,
well
go ahead.
Either one, E.J. Dionne.
You know, but you use the Depression. Ronald Reagan used the economic downturn to push a very conservative economic program, but the program was intimately linked to curing the downturn. They were connected. Similarly, FDR's bold program was connected to ending the Depression, whether it fully worked or not. I think in this case, it's apples and oranges, and I think Jack Beatty, anybody who knows, understands James Michael Curley, clearly understands politics. But what Jack Beatty put his finger on it, it's when you link up patriotism itself to a particular partisan or ideological agenda, that's when you start making the people who disagree with you rather angry.
And because you're painting them as un-American.
Indirectly. Indirectly. And it has that effect. And it's sort of using patriotic symbols for purposes that, you know, are not necessarily automatically patriotic. And the flag, the revival of the flag after 9/11, I thought was one of the most powerful things. The flag had been a divisive symbol for a long time because of what happened during Vietnam. It shouldn't be divisive. After 9/11, it became unifying again. And so I think people are very sensitive to saying, look, patriotism is over here. And then on the other side, we have our partisan battles, and they should be kept a little bit apart.
E.J. Dionne, Jack Beatty, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to turn to them. Listeners, what word, what phrase describes the State of the Union to you tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dusty's calling from Pepperell, Massachusetts. Hi, Dusty. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Thanks. I would say, you know, State of the Union, afraid. My wife asks me every night, I mean, am I going to lose my job? I mean, she's going to be secure. I think the same thing. You know, 2 weeks ago, I was listening to Ted Koppel, and they were talking about the scenario of an atomic war with North Korea, which, you know, I mean, it's very afraid. It's almost like people have, I mean, I guess to be frank, I just don't have any confidence in Bush. Mr. Beatty talked about the wartime president, but if you look after 9/11, it took him 4 days to get to New York City and 3 to get to Washington.
But but Dusty, President Bush has built so much of his presidency since that attack on his bold opposition to terror, on his fearlessness.
We haven't gotten Bin Laden. We haven't gotten, you know, we really don't. I mean, they're making ricin in London. That scares the heck out of me when there's no antidote for the stuff. I mean, I'm scared. The United States now, to me, is a poster child for the rest of the world to, you know, for what Bush stands for. I mean, it's.
And what is that Bush stands for?
Just like you're talking about, that I'm going to do it my way, and then you know, that's the only way. There's the right way, the wrong way, and the Bush way, and I don't care about anything else, and I'm going to do it this way, and this is the way. I just, you know, there's no faith in him, nothing. I mean, the economy. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I lived through Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I was scared, but now I know I'm scared.
Dusty, we've got it. The word from Dusty's Corner tonight is afraid, and he sees a my way or the highway attitude in George Bush. E.J. Dionne?
Well, I think that one of the problems he's had on Iraq is that a minority of the country still, but a growing minority, and also obviously our friends in Europe, feel that he's engaged much more in assertion rather than persuasion. I think phrases such as the one he used last week where, you know, I've seen this movie before and I don't want to see it again, that's not persuasion. Now, tonight, you know, Mike Gerson, the president's speechwriter, is one of the best people to hold that job in a long time, and I'm sure tonight he will be far more eloquent and will try to be much more persuasive. But I think he has to overcome a sense that the gentleman expressed on the phone. Again, that's still a minority of the country, but his problem is that minority is growing.
And Jack, Tom, just to interject, Dusty mentioned fear of losing a job. Every president since Harry Truman, has net created jobs in his tenure. George Bush, thus far, has net lost jobs. He's got to change that, or he will have the single worst economic record judged in that metric, which is the one that matters to many Americans, of any president since the Second World War.
You know, Jack, E.J., it must make President Bush just cringe if and when he hears a citizen like Dusty say that he feels more fear, because George Bush has based so much of his stature, his appeal, on sticking his chest out and saying, by golly, we are not going to be afraid. Freedom over fear. His own phrase, E.J. Dionne.
Well, I think that's true. And I think that, but, you know, in the initial phases after 9/11, what overcame fear was solidarity, and the feelings of national solidarity were even more important than the fact that we were afraid.
Yes.
As time has gone on since 9/11, there's still a lot of solidarity, obviously, against terror, still a lot of solidarity in support of firefighters and cops, but there's less solidarity across party lines than there was. And just as Jack said, a lot of questions about, okay, we've had this year and a half now, are we really safer? And then the question, will a war against Saddam Hussein make us safer? And again, the president's got to make the case that it will tonight.
Well, there's the fear factor. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm actually going to follow up on what one of the earlier callers said. I would say the State of the Union is terribly misled. And I think part of this, I have to really fault the media. You guys were not as bad, meaning public media, not quite as bad as the networks, but still the Bush has been given a free ride since way before the election.
In what respect, David?
His character, his connections, and his real politics. As somebody said earlier, how deeply conservative he is. That was not the Bush that campaigned, but the media didn't really expose that.
Well, the word was compassionate conservative, and that's the word that we're going to hear tonight again, we're told.
He was also the biggest executioner of any governor in modern times.
David, you raise a tough point. Let me put it right in E.J. Dionne's lap. E.J. Dionne, how about it? The media has let the country down, our caller says.
Well, as you know, anybody who reads me knows, I've been a Bush critic, so I sort of half want to defend my colleagues and half agree with the caller. I wrote a column a couple of months back arguing that we have to stop talking about the liberal media because it doesn't really exist anymore, if it ever did. And I could make your case that it did. Yeah, Barry Goldwater sure didn't get a great shake from the media. But I think for a long time now, if you look at the conservative attack on the media over a period of 30 years, it's had an effect. And I think the mainstream media is rather moderate, and that after 9/11, I think for some understandable reasons, there was less enthusiasm for going after President Bush. But that's just the old media. The new media, mostly talk radio and cable television, definitely tilts toward the right, not toward the left. So if you net it all out, I think you have a media which is somewhat more conservative and therefore did give President Bush a relatively easy ride. But again, I'd underscore 9/11 in that. He was getting pretty tough press, starting to get tough press before 9/11. And I think everybody pulled back as part of the same feeling of national solidarity. And I think now it's toughening up again. The thing about polls is they are a rich get richer phenomenon. As on the way up, you're probably pushed up by the way you're covered and talked about.
Right.
But when you're on the way down, you're probably pushed down because people start talking about, boy, is this guy in trouble. And I think the president's in danger
around
of being in that phase.
E.J. Dionne, we'll learn a lot tonight in a speech coming right up. Thank you so much for joining us. It's just great to have
you. Thank you.
E.J. Dionne is columnist with The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We're talking tonight about the State of the Union, about President Bush at midterm. Are you better off tonight than you were a year ago, 2 years ago? What do you want to hear from George Bush tonight on the war, on the economy, on the State of the Union? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the State of the Union, about President Bush at midterm. It will only be a matter of minutes now before the president enters the House of Representatives chambers, goes to the podium to give his State of the Union address. At this moment, what word, what phrase describes the State of the Union in your mind? And are we better off tonight than we were a year ago, 2 years ago? Does George W. Bush take the credit? Does he take the blame? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now by Byron York. Joins us from Washington, D.C. He's White House correspondent for the National Review. Good evening and welcome, Byron York.
Hi, good to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us. So, Byron, give us your view. The National Review has a big, muscular, conservative view of things. How's the president doing?
Well, first of all, I think the president's doing quite well. On the question of are you better off than you were 2 years ago, of course we're not better off than we were 2 years ago. 2 years ago, the economy was beginning to dip, but we were not in the problems that we're in today. And much, much more importantly, we were blissfully unaware that terrorists on the other side of the planet planned to blow down the World Trade Center.
You're absolutely right, Brian York.
Pentagon.
We carefully asked that question with two time references, one a year ago and the other 2 years ago, and yes, a lot has intervened. And yet, as an election comes back, people are going to be asking, how are we doing here?
Well, of course, and I think the thing the president has going for him is that there's an enormous leadership gap between him and the Democrats, and I think people sense that. One, I think they feel, and I think most polls show this, they feel much more comfortable with the president running the foreign policy, which is good because that's what the Constitution demands, than the Democratic Party in the Senate. And I think that as far as the economy goes, I think the president has the advantage of having a plan, having a growth plan that a number of people seem to think will help, will stimulate economic growth, will help the stock market recover, whereas Democrats, the plan seems to be essentially carping and conceding, for example, on tax cuts, saying, well, we'll have a little bit of tax cuts for a year only, and then we'll go back. So I think that the president has the advantage of actually having a plan, believing in it, and pushing it. So I think that he's actually in a pretty good shape relative to his opponents.
So in comparative terms, you think he's looking pretty good at this moment. What about, I guess, on both of these? First, on the economic front, what about the wobble on Capitol Hill in even Republican support for the full $674 billion Bush stimulus plan?
Well, see, I think that points out the wisdom of Bush going for the whole enchilada to begin with. Specifically on the issue of taxes on dividends, it was something that was going to be attacked, and you're absolutely right. Charles Grassley, chairman of the Finance Committee, has said, you know, I don't think we can get this out in its full form. So why not ask for the whole thing and settle for some larger part of it than you would have gotten had you
otherwise
asked for a smaller part to begin with?
And how about on the war front? You know, as we've heard tonight, that the numbers there are dwindling. The support is not what it was. On the other hand, President Bush has shown himself pretty forceful in rallying Americans on the conflict front. Do you think he'll do that tonight?
I think there's a real possibility he will. You remember last August, there was a lot of talk about how there was no support for the war. Bush had to go to the United Nations. He had to try to make his case. And he went to the United Nations in early September and made, I think, what even his opponents say was a masterful case for enforcing all the United Nations resolutions that had called on Iraq to disarm. And I think that he does have to do something similar to that either tonight or in the days to come. We hear a lot about Secretary Powell next week making a case.
Maybe bringing out some more intelligence information, we're told.
Out more evidence of the Iraqis hiding weapons or components of weapons of mass destruction. So, yeah, Bush is in a sense in a position where he has to make a case, and I think you're going to see that tonight, but you're also going to see significant follow-through next week on the part of the administration.
Byron York, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to turn to the phones for a moment. Chris is calling from Harwich, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great. I had called earlier. You had a series of anti-Bush calls.
It got a bit gloomy there about Bush, didn't it?
Yeah, it got a little gloomy, and it's changing a little bit now with your current guest. My point basically is this. George Bush is president now in a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of anti-Bush sentiment in terms of his position on the war. My question is, why do people think Bush is doing this? Do they think he enjoys waging war, or that he has some personal gain by starting a war with Iraq? I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that he's doing this because he's surrounded by some intelligent people, and it's pretty obvious that he needs to be doing this to protect the United States. And I just don't understand why people question, his motives. I mean, I think people have the right to question, but I don't think he's doing this because he likes to do it. I think there's a real reason he needs to do it. I think we need to listen to him tonight, and I hope that he can spell out why he's going to do what he's going to do.
I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that tonight. And Chris, thanks for your call. Let me put it to both of my guys here. Jack Beatty, you first. Chris says, why question the president's move to war? He's defending the country, for crying out loud.
Well, the president doesn't enjoy it. No one is implying that, although it's clear that he will benefit politically from a war if things go well. But the question is, why is he doing it? I think the answer is partly given us by people like Norman Schwarzkopf, who in an interview today in the Washington Post says, I haven't seen the evidence. And he said, I'm frightened when I hear some of these, quote, intelligent advisors like Donald Rumsfeld talk. I think, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this, that the president is basically laboring under a fundamental strategic misperception about what the threat is to this country and how an intervention in the Middle East will affect Osama bin Laden. What does bin Laden want above all? A U.S. intervention in the Middle East. What does he want above all? He wants a day. That's coming up in March, according to CBS News.
A day
for attack when 300 cruise missiles, according to CBS News, are to be fired into Baghdad. What does he want any more than that? And Bush simply has not seen what is our real threat. And I think this is as grave a misperception of the dangers to America as Lyndon Johnson displayed in Vietnam.
Byron York, what about it? Is this president defending the nation or stumbling into a briar patch he doesn't want to get into?
Well, first of all, I think the president's most ideological opponents do attribute bad motives to him. They say he's doing it for oil or for Cheney, for his friends at Halliburton, mm-hmm. or he's doing it because his daddy didn't finish the job the first time. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of people who actually do attribute bad motives to the president on this. But I think the problem here is, what do you do about these United Nations resolutions that have been passed for the last dozen years, in which the United Nations demanded that Iraq disarm or that there would be serious consequences? This was the basis of Bush's successful speech to the UN last September 12th.
We understand that, but how does that – let's just say for a moment that being a stickler on that front
–
yes, of course, and that's important, and it goes to the credibility of the UN. But what if – I don't know if you acknowledge this possibility, but what if going to war is in fact not in the national interest, even though it does support the credibility of the United Nations?
Well, I think the president has determined, and it's very clear now that the president has determined that war is in the national interest. And I have to tell you that I think we're in a position, even if you're opposed to the war, that we're in a situation of seriously diminished American credibility if Saddam Hussein is in power a year from now or any time beyond that.
You're just not concerned that it could play in, as Jack Beatty suggests, to a greater kind of terror move.
Listen, these terrorists killed 3,000 Americans, took down the World Trade Centers. I think the idea that we shouldn't do anything to rile them, that maybe they'll leave us alone if we just don't do anything to make them angry, is really a wrong approach to take to the subject. I think we have to try to proactively undermine them in the Middle East on a variety of fronts, one of which would be deposing Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just the beginning. Byron York, Jack Beatty, stand by. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks.
I'd like to make a couple points. I think a lot of people that supported Bush are just feeling a little duped at this point. I mean, they supported him in the war on terrorism, and they saw him take all that political support and turn it into outrageous tax breaks for his friends, and they're just feeling a little silly. I think that if at any point he had turned to his core constituency and said, you know, the wealthy in this country have to do a little more for the country at this point of emergency, he would be invincible today, but he didn't do that.
Were you a supporter, David, or not?
Not at the last election, mm-hmm. but yeah, I supported him after the 9/11, sure.
Byron York, what about this point?
I think he squandered that support, and now people are also concerned about his judgment in foreign affairs. I mean, I think they support the Colin Powell foreign policy,
uh-huh.
but they don't like to see this constant tug of war between the hardliners and Colin Powell, who reassures people, and our closest allies are now telling us that, you know, every day now that we're going a little bit off the wall.
Well, maybe not our very closest allies, but we've got the point, David. And thanks for making it, Byron York. What about this? Is there a tension between the president's desire for a nation united in a war against terrorism, perhaps a hot war in Iraq, And David saying that the profile of tax cuts and benefits, which seem to go largely to wealthier Americans.
Two things. I don't really see the connection. I mean, first of all, the president's original tax cut plan was passed in the spring of 2001, so it was clearly when we were all unaware, unfortunately, of the threat that was coming. The other thing about Colin Powell is that I think it's a very good thing that Powell has been at the administration. I think it's a very good thing that the administration has had conflicting or at least dissenting voices mm-hmm. at the very highest levels. On the other hand, I think it also seems to be true that Powell has gotten very hawkish in recent days, and I do think he has the credibility because he doubted some of the drive toward war, because he wanted to go through the United Nations. I think his current hawkishness and his seeming belief that Iraq really is in material breach of the United Nations resolutions, I think that has a lot of credibility right now.
We've all seen that, and duly acknowledged. He was very tough over the last weekend, and it looks like he's going to continue in that vein. But I want to take you back to our caller David's other point and ask again, is there a tension between the president calling the whole country together and laying down tax cuts that appear to favor wealthier Americans?
I just don't see that. I don't think people make that connection. Frankly, I don't make that connection. And certainly, you can oppose the president's tax cut, and you can say that either he shouldn't be doing it, or we should lop the top 1% off, or something like that. But I'm not sure how that would affect the sort of patriotic support of the president that occurs when the nation goes to war, or the generalized support of the president in a war against terrorism that's been around since September 11th.
Jack Beatty, do you see a tension on that front?
Well, I do. I mean, historically, in every single war we've had, the call has gone out for sacrifice, and sacrifice has meant paying taxes, especially for the wealthy. In fact, FDR said it is a privilege to pay taxes in wartime, especially for those who are benefiting from it. The president has gone precisely in the opposite direction. And again, the feeling is that he's using the war to pay off his political, the people who supported him, his base. And you know, the unique fact about Mr. Bush's reelection campaign, the unique fact about it, is that he will be the only sitting president to run for office without public matching funds. He's going to raise all his money privately.
Well, now he's done that successfully in the past. Byron York, I want to get just a bit more from you. We've got not much time here, but give us your sense of the perfect union as George W. Bush envisions it. What is that vision, I guess, in foreign policy? Is it the bold America straddling the world, making things right?
Well, I think it's evolving. I mean, it's far, far different today than it was before September 11th. But I think his vision of the world is more of a vision of American security. And I think that what all Americans feel after September 11th is that we cannot allow ourselves to be in that position again. And I think that the differences between Americans, of course, are the degree of aggressiveness that the United States should adopt in making sure that this happens. But I think Bush's position is to clearly in his whole doctrine of preemption is to identify threats and take them out ahead of time. It's a very, very different situation than we've had in the past. But on the other hand, the post September 11th world is a different situation than we've had in the past. So I think his vision of a world is of a secure America.
A secure America. Those are words and sentiments I'm sure we'll hear tonight. Byron York, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Byron York is White House correspondent for the National Review. Jack Beatty, the president will be making his way into those chambers very shortly tonight. And one thing he's going to say is the American flag stands for more than our power and our interest. The word compassion is going to be there.
Well, let's hear about it. Let's hear where the compassion is going to happen here on the home front, whether it's going to happen in tax cuts that middle-class people can use, or whether it's going to be for dividend drawers. Let's hear about compassion for poor people. Let's hear about compassion for seniors.
Well, I expect we'll hear all of that. How we interpret it is another question, and a question for another day. We'll all be listening. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR Boston.